IFPRI and World Food Program event, cash food or vouchers, evidence from a four-country experimental study, held on October 23, 2013, in Washington, D.C. Speaker John Hodnott, Deputy Director of the Poverty, Health, and Nutrition Division at IFPRI.
Thank you very much to everyone for coming out today. I want to begin with some acknowledgments and thanks. First of all, as you'll see from the slide in front of you, this has been a team effort. Five members of the team, Dan Gilligan, Melissa Hudrobo, Amy Margolis, Ben Schwab, and Shalini Roy, have joined with us for the presentation today. They're quietly sitting at the front. They're a fabulous group of researchers to work with, both skilled and dedicated. And they told me that they look forward to the very hard and penetrating questions you will put to them during the Q&A. I would like to thank WFP, with whom we've worked in close partnership over the last 3 years on this work, under the leadership of Annalisa Conti, prior to her to Lynn Brown, and many staff in WFP, both in Rome and in the field, who worked very closely with us to ensure this project could be a success. Finally, our research group also receives financial support through the Policies, Institutions, and Markets Research Program of the CGIAR, and it's a pleasure to acknowledge their contribution to this event, along with the contribution of our Communications Division, particularly Gwen and her team, for pulling this together. Our starting point with this work is the following question, or the following proposition. What do we know about the relative advantages and drawbacks of providing assistance in the form of food or cash in developing countries? The important word in this question is the word relative. And if we focus on that word in this question, the answer, certainly as of 2010 or so, when we began this work, is very little. Why do we say that? Well, as Annalisa noted in her introductory remarks, there are many studies where people looked at the impact of food transfers. There are other studies when people looked at the impact of cash transfers, and some that have looked at vouchers. But when we look at these studies, and we look at them closely in a comparative sense, we realize they are of limited value in our ability to make direct comparisons between the impact of in-kind and cash transfers. And why is that? Is, well, when we look at these studies, we see that someone will have done a study in one country where they looked at the impact of a small cash transfer for 2 months, against another country where they looked at a large food transfer for 14 months. So when we look at the results and we try and compare across those two, we can't really tell if it's the difference in receiving cash or food, or was it the difference in the size of the transfer, the duration of the transfer, or the location in which those transfers were situated. And that then is the reason why, in fact, our relative knowledge of the impact of food and cash transfers is so limited. Further, for those of you who work in the policy area, you will have noticed that oftentimes this issue is dominated by ideology and politics. People will say things like, beneficiaries always prefer to receive cash, or the only way we can ensure people are fed is if we give them food. And in an environment where there's an absence of good relative information on cash and food transfers, those ideological or political statements, often which are backed up by, at best, scant evidence, are allowed to run free. What we would like to move towards is a world where we can try and answer this question in a fairly compelling fashion. And what do we mean by a compelling fashion? Well, first of all, we would like to work in the same setting, where we implement a transfer intervention that keeps all aspects of the intervention the same. What do I mean? Same in terms of the value of the transfers, the frequency of those transfers, the payment dates on which those transfers are made. The only thing we want to vary is the modality, whether that be cash or food or vouchers. And not only that, we want to vary these modalities in a random way, so there is no confounding effect of the location in which you work with the type of modality you've chosen. The consequence of such a setup is that we can ascribe differences in impacts to the modality themselves, and not these other confounding factors such as location or intervention design. Well, we could do that, and that would give us one data point. and one data point, supposing it was from Uganda. Someone would say, well, you have this for Uganda, but is it really true in Latin America? Or I'm a Yemen person, what does Uganda have to say to me? So we want to do this actually in more than one place. In other words, we want to do it in a variety of settings. And what I'm going to present to you today is the result of our 3-year partnership with WFP, where we attempted to do precisely just this. I'll begin by briefly describing the interventions themselves, discuss the evaluation design briefly, and then focus on our core findings, both on impacts and also on costs. We have some additional findings, which I'll just flag briefly, and then we'll end up with some summary remarks and some potential implications moving forward. So we have, in the study, we have 4 different country settings. I've chosen to reflect a variety of localities in which organizations like WFP typically work. The first is in Ecuador, where the intervention was situated in the northern provinces of Carchi and Sucumbíos, and in a locality where there was a very large influx of refugees from neighboring Colombia. And in Ecuador, over a 6-month period, beneficiaries were randomized to receive, on a monthly basis, either $40 in cash, $40 in food vouchers, or a food basket worth $40, which consisted of rice, vegetable oil, lentils, and canned sardines. All beneficiaries received nutrition sensitization. Roughly 75% of the beneficiaries in the Ecuador study were women. Our second study was what you could just almost describe as the polar opposite of urban Ecuador. Now, it was in a rural area of Niger, in the Mara department of the Zinder region, an area characterized historically by very high levels of seasonal food insecurity. In this study, households participated in public works for 3 months, followed by receiving 3 months of unconditional transfers. Because the intervention was organized around the work sites where the public works took place, beneficiaries were randomized at the work site level to receive monthly payments of either cash, approximately $55 per household, or an in-kind payment consisting of cereals, pulses, vegetable oils, and iodized salt. Transfers were made to the household head, of whom approximately 75% were male and 25% were female. Our third country was Uganda, where in Uganda, these transfers were linked to households' participation in early childhood development centers set up and operated with support from UNICEF. This work took place in 3 districts of Karamoja, which is a very poor, rugged, and also post-conflict subregion in eastern Uganda, characterized with high seasonal food insecurity. In Uganda, households were randomized to receive either a cash payment through mobile money cards or a food payment consisting of multiple micronutrient fortified corn soy blend and vitamin A fortified sugar. Transfers were received every 6 to 8 weeks for 12 months, over a six transfer cycle period, and transfers were made preferentially to the mother of the child. Finally, in Yemen, transfers were made in 2 rural districts of governance with high baseline levels of food insecurity. This was an area that was not characterized by conflict when we started, but was on the edge of conflict as that developed in Yemen over the course of the study. 3 transfers were made on a bi-monthly basis, either of cash or of food. And in Yemen, approximately 20% of the beneficiaries were female-headed households. So we have 4 study settings, ranging with a very diverse set of localities. Okay, urban areas with refugees, post-conflict situations, what you could describe as classic Sahelian seasonal food insecurity, and so on. And also tied to a range of other activities. Works in some case, early childhood development others, unconditional transfers, but with nutrition sensitization in a third, and so on and so forth. So across these 4 countries, we capture a diverse range of locales and modes of operation. What we then do is in this study, is we address 3 core questions across all 4 countries. And these are, how did the benefits of cash or vouchers compare to these food transfers? Does the delivery of these modalities cost less using one modality type rather than another? And finally, what are households' preferences? What would people prefer to receive and the way of these types of modalities. And these issues will be the primary focus of the presentation. To do this, we look at two core indicators in order to assess the impacts of the intervention. The first is WFP's principal food security indicator, which they use widely in their work. And this is something called the food consumption score. The food consumption score is calculated by constructing a number of different food groups from survey data and asking households the number of times each food group was consumed in the last 7 days. Each food group is then given a weight, and the weights are given in the table at the bottom of the slide. So for example, if you have a household which, for example, consumes maize porridge every day, that adds 14 points to the food consumption score. 7 days times a weight of 2. These weights have been calculated by WFP to reflect the relative nutritional value of these different types of foods. So for example, as you can see, more weight is given to things like meat and dairy, and much less weight is given to things like sugar and fats. Households are considered food insecure, with a food consumption score is less than 35, or in the case of Yemen, 28, and have poor food security status if the FCS is less than 21. At baseline, reflecting that diversity of localities in which the study was fielded, the percentage of households that were considered food insecure ranged from 10% in Ecuador to 53% in Uganda. In 3 of the 4 countries, it was also possible to collect data and construct a second measure of household food security, namely household caloric acquisition of calories. To do this, a detailed module asking households about the different food items they had consumed in the last 7 days was fielded, as well as the quantities of those items that were consumed. And this allows us to calculate the second measure of household food security. It's important to note, and you'll see this as we start to get to the results, that while both the FCS and caloric acquisition can increase together or can fall together, that isn't necessarily always going to be the case. So for example, caloric acquisition can rise without there being much change in the food consumption score. And this would be a case, for example, where there's an increased consumption of the quantity of staples, but not increase in the frequency of their consumption or the frequency of consumption of other goods. Similarly, the FCS can change without caloric consumption, or caloric acquisition changing very much. So for example, where a household is receiving cash and it uses some of that cash to purchase fruits or vegetables, that will increase the diversity of household diet, but will have little impact on caloric availability at the household level. In addition, we had a series of additional research questions which were specific to the countries in which the work that was fielded. And this reflected both the interests of the particular WFP country office, it reflected particular design features of the interventions, and it reflected also opportunities to explore additional outcomes. And these include outcomes as they relate to nutrition, to early childhood development, to intra-household decision-making, to economic and social relations across households, purchase of agricultural inputs, and also the expenditures on undesirable goods, which is another thing which I'll come back to later in this presentation. In Ecuador and Uganda, it was possible to set up the evaluation design so that households were randomized to receive different types of modalities, food, cash, and in the case of Ecuador, also vouchers. But it was also possible to have a randomized control group, households that did not receive any transfers. And so for those countries, we can actually approach the issue of these relative effects in 2 ways. One of which is we can look at the impact of each modality relative to not receiving anything at all, just a randomized control group. Or we can look at the relative effects of cash, and in the case of Ecuador, vouchers, relative to receiving food. The other countries in Niger and Yemen, where we do not have a pure control group, we answer only one question. What is the impact of cash relative to that of food? So with that, we now turn to the results. And what I will do is I will walk you slowly for the first slide and then start to go a little faster. So recall, in Ecuador and in Uganda, we have what we call these pure control groups, households that do not receive anything. We do a survey before these interventions start. We do a survey as these interventions end. and we look at changes in the outcomes of interest. So if we look at the change in the food consumption score, and we look, for example, at the first bar for Ecuador food, that tells us that relative to households that received no food, there was a 5-point increase, or to be precise, a 4.95 increase in the food consumption score for those households that received food in Ecuador. For households that received cash, the increase in the food consumption score was 5.7 points, and for households that received vouchers, it was larger than the other two, 9 points. We also see results there for Uganda, where there's no effect of food, and cash, where there is a small effect. So what this tells us is that, in effect, if we look, for example, at the Ecuador results, when you give people transfers of various sorts, we observe changes in this particular measure of food security, the food consumption score. We can also do this for caloric acquisition. Here again, walking you through, we see, for example, in Ecuador, caloric acquisition rises by 16% for households that receive food, 6% for households that receive cash, and 11% for households that receive vouchers. Again, relative to the group that not receive anything. And you also have the Uganda results there as well. So what this tells us, again, is that if you give people resources, they use it to increase their acquisition of food, measured either in calories or in this measure which reflects both quantity and also variety of foods in the diet. And while this is of interest, it's not really getting at the core question we posed at the beginning. What are the relative effects of food as opposed to cash? And that's what we present in this slide. So in this slide, we'll take one intervention as an example, and then we'll use that to illustrate the others. So let's take the results we have for Yemen. See, the bar is going up, and you see the number is 9.2 on that bar. What that tells us is that in the Yemen study, there was a 9.2 percentage change increase in the food consumption score for households that received cash relative to those households that received food. Okay? Yemen, it's quite possible, indeed it was the case, that people who received food increased their consumption of food, but the relative effect comparing cash and food was larger for those households that received cash. You see that's true in Yemen, you see it's true in Uganda, you see it's true in Ecuador for vouchers, and for cash, basically the effects of cash on the food consumption score relative to food is basically the same, which is why it's just a very slight increase. But you also notice in Niger, you observe the opposite. In Niger, either measured during the hungry season or the post-harvest season, the food consumption score effectively increased by a smaller amount if you received cash. Or to rephrase it differently, if you are a household randomized to be part of the group that received food transfers, your dietary diversity, which is measured by the FCS, improved more if you got the food basket than if you received cash. Well, we can then also look at this in terms of caloric acquisition. And again, we do this relative comparison of food and cash, which we could do across these different countries. If we start with Ecuador, for both cash and for vouchers, we see that cash had a relatively smaller effect on caloric acquisition relative to food. 10 percentage points for cash, 5 percentage points for vouchers. We observe a similar phenomenon in Yemen, not in Uganda. And in Niger, although we do not have direct evidence on caloric acquisition, we have inferential evidence that would suggest to us that cash transfers are likely to have increased caloric acquisition relative to food. So this slide and the previous slide reflect the core of our results. And as I look around the room, I can see some people are smiling, some people are frowning, and many people are looking, what's going on? Bearing in mind that we have a sample size of 4 countries, so we need to be careful in terms of our ability to extrapolate and to generalize, what we'd like to offer is, in some sense, our assessment of what we think is actually driving these differential results. In differential results, there really are 3. Why is it we observe this pattern on the food consumption scores? rising in some places but falling in others when people receive cash relative to food? Why is it that the pattern that we see for the FCS is by and large reversed when we change the indicator and look at caloric acquisition instead? And one of the ways in which we can tell the story is to take our polar extremes in terms of our study areas and work through the characteristics of those and the implications that has for these results. So we start off with Ecuador. Ecuador, recall, the intervention takes place in an area where there's an influx of refugees, but it's also in an area which is largely urban. And it's an area where if one looks at the food markets, one is struck by the richness or the thickness of these food markets, not only in grains, but almost every food imaginable. Okay? And access to food, whether it's fruits or vegetables or dairy, you can get it from like a local market stall, you can get it from someone who's got a small shop, you could even go to the supermarket and get those foods there. Food is widely available in all forms. Second, of our four study sites, relatively speaking, Ecuador is the wealthiest of the four. Again, the word relative is very important here. We're not saying these people are rich by any stretch of the imagination. But compared to the other localities in which these studies are cited, these households are relatively better off. Now let's take at the other extreme, Niger. Niger is, the work is situated in an area where people are astonishingly poor, where even meeting minimum caloric requirements represents a considerable challenge. And it's also an area where, although there are well-functioning grain markets, markets for other types of foodstuffs are either limited or absent. So put these ideas together, and we have the following possibility. We know from 30 years of work done on the relationship between income and caloric acquisition, when households are very, very poor, they put a great deal of primacy on acquiring additional calories when they receive additional income. Households become somewhat better off, and particularly when they move above minimum caloric thresholds, that relationship starts to change, with there being less desire or emphasis on acquiring more calories, and much greater emphasis on improving the quality of the diversity of diet. So in the case of Ecuador, we have these relatively well-off households with the ability to actually, with their cash transfers, buy a much greater variety of foods. That's reflected both in the voucher and the cash results. In Niger, we have these extraordinarily poor households where, given this cash, the behavior we observe is they go out and buy large quantities of staples. So in the Niger study, prior to the intervention, typically when people went to the market, they might buy 1 or 2 kilos of sorghum or millet. The households that received cash were going out and buying 50 or 100 kilos of these coarse grains instead. That behavior will increase caloric acquisition in Niger, but it's not going to do a whole lot necessarily for the diversity of diet. And instead, those households that receive the food basket are, by the construction of that basket, receiving a more diverse diet, right? Because not only are they receiving the grains, they're also receiving the pulses and the oils. And we look at individual food items within that, that's where we see the biggest change in the Niger study. So that gives us some explanation as to why we can observe these differences across some of the countries we observe. It also gives us some insights into why, in fact, we observe different results for the caloric acquisition than we do for the food consumption score. However, if you were a dyed-in-the-wool neoclassical economist, you would say, well, hang on, no, there's something not right with the story. What's not right is surely anyone who receives a food basket, if they didn't want that food, they could just go out and sell it. The phrase that they would like to use is just monetize the benefits, okay? Turn it into cash and use that cash however you want to use. Well, we wondered about that in the context of this study, and a very striking finding is virtually no one sells their food transfers, okay? The word virtually and no should go together, as in, sure, we can find one or two households or a few households in each study who do that or do a little bit of that, but the dominant feature across all studies, is that households do not sell their food rations. They consume them instead. Some of that consumption might displace purchases that they would make otherwise, which can explain why, for example, you can observe small increases in the food consumption score, even in households receiving food transfers. But by and large, they make a change in their consumption pattern, an increase quantity and not so much quality or diversity. So this gives us explanations of both why we observe these patterns across countries and why these patterns might differ according to the outcome measure that we use. The final point we want to note is someone who's noted in the back of their room saying, well, what exactly is going on with Uganda? And on Uganda, we just want to offer a cautionary note. Because of some differences in the timing of the last set of transfers, our strong suspicion is the results on food for Uganda are slightly understated. Had the timing been a bit different on those transfers, the difference between the cash and food would probably have been smaller than what we observe here. The general pattern would have remained the same. So up to now, as we've talked about these results, we've talked about relative impacts across different dimensions, across different countries. But that actually really is only part of the story. Not only do we want to know what these relative impacts are, we'd like to get a sense of what are the relative costs of actually providing these types of interventions. And that's work that we undertook in all four countries. My colleague Amy Margolis did quite a lot of this work. And this is an area where we really have to again thank WFP, because in order to make these calculations, we required not only incredibly detailed access to their financial records, but also a lot of actually their staff time to help us interpret those and to actually understand how the modalities were actually implemented. Our starting point in this costing exercise is to exclude the value of the transfer itself. What I mean by that is, for example, in the context of Niger, in Niger, the cash transfers were worth $55. We will assume it cost WFP $55 to obtain the food that went into that transfer. Now, we'll come back in a little while and relax this assumption, but that's kind of a useful starting point. One way of phrasing this or describing this is to say, imagine a world where, for example, in Niger, food has come into Niger under WFP's control and is sitting in a warehouse outside Niamey, the capital. Similarly, money has come into Niger under WFP's control and is sitting in a WFP bank account, also in Niamey. How much does it cost then to get that money or that food from Niamey out to the beneficiaries in Marad Department? In other words, what we want to focus on are the modality-specific costs of delivery. Staff time, the goods, the services that are specific to the modality chosen. So for example, on food, there are going to be staff and monetary costs associated with in-country transport, with ration preparation and distribution. Cash, there are costs associated with contract preparation, with financial institutions who provide, who actually deliver the cash. A number of countries, they use electronic means of delivery. So there are debit cards which are used. In the case of Niger, for example, in each village where the transfers, cash transfers took place, depending on the time of year, either every 2 weeks or every month, the MFI would drive an ATM into the village, and everyone would line up, give them their cards, and withdraw their payments from that ATM. Vouchers. In Ecuador, we also have vouchers. When people say, well, what is the cost of providing vouchers? Well, surely it can't be that much, right? All you need to do is you just need to run them off, you know, print out a whole bunch, and that should be it. Well, it turns out with vouchers, it's actually a lot more complicated than that. First of all, you have to decide or determine which supermarkets are actually both willing and able to actually handle a voucher scheme. And that requires quite a lot of staff time to go out and speak with those supermarkets to assess whether or not they're really capable of actually doing this and drawing up the contracts for them. But then when the vouchers come back to you, it's probably not a bad idea to check them, because who knows? I mean, it's possible, for example, some supermarkets might think, you know, why don't we photocopy a few extra vouchers and just slip them into the packet we send to WFP? So for example, with vouchers, one of the big costs was actually the liquidation of the checking of the vouchers or their accounting when they came back to WFP in Quito. In this exercise, there are going to be some costs which are common across modalities. So, for example, in Ecuador, The country office decided that households that were to be beneficiaries would be selected through the implementation of a proxy means test. Now, irrespective of whether or not WFP was providing food or cash or vouchers, they were going to incur the cost of that proxy means test. And because that's a common cost across all modalities, we could either treat it, we could divide it equally across all of them, or we could just exclude that cost from our calculation. What we really want to focus on are these modality-specific costs. And the way in which we then phrase this is to say, well, how much does it cost to make a transfer in cash relative to a food transfer? And the answer is, the cash transfers are always cheaper than the food transfers. So in order to compare these across countries, we do it on a per transfer basis. In Ecuador, it costs $8.47 less to make a cash transfer than a food transfer, $8.91 less in Niger, and you can also see the numbers for Uganda, for Yemen, and for Ecuador vouchers. Now you say, okay, well, costs a little less. So what? Does that really make a difference? Well, consider the following example. In Niger, the monthly transfer was worth $55. The modality-specific cost of the cash transfer was $4, and the modality-specific cost of the food transfers was $12.91. Okay, in Niger, so there are six transfers. In other words, if you have a cash household, it costs $354 to make those six transfers to a beneficiary household. Okay, $55 for the transfer, $4 for the modality-specific cost. It costs $407.46, if you're being precise, to make six food transfers to beneficiary households. Now suppose, as was the case in Niger, you have a budget of $2 million. And we'll abstract from things like these more general costs, such as the targeting and selection, and say, well, supposing you could spend that $2 million either on providing cash or providing food. Or another way of phrasing it is that if we could do it all over again, supposing we actually did everything the same except everyone got cash, how many households could we cover? Well, we have the budget, $2 million. We know how much it costs to give these transfers to each household. Take the first number, divide it by the second. And for cash households, if we only provided cash, we could provide these transfers to approximately 5,600 households. Same mathematical exercise for food, not surprisingly, because the modality-specific costs are higher. You'd be able to provide these transfers to a smaller number of households if you used food instead of cash. The difference is about 700 households. 700 households, 740, given the households in Niger are relatively large, 6.8 people, that would mean if you could do it all over again, same intervention design in terms of the public works and conditional transfers, same villages, same value of transfer, but given in cash rather than food, you could have fed another 5,000 people over that 6-month period. We do the calculation for all four countries, and across all four countries, using this information on modality-specific costs and the value of the transfers, if we could do it all over again and switched everyone from food to cash over the 6-month period in which these transfer programs typically operated, you could have fed another 32,800 people. And that, at least to us, sounds like a big number. A final comment. At the outset, I said we're going to assume that the cost of WFP of a $40 food transfer, for example, in the case of Ecuador, is $40. Now, if you believed that WFP, we'll make this, maybe for the WFP people here, we're going to call this a hypothetical example, just to be clear, okay? If you believed that WFP is hopelessly inefficient, okay? You might say, well, that's silly, that's absurd. I mean, it must cost more than $40 because they're so much more inefficient than the private sector to actually provide a food basket worth $40. So you're actually flattering, in some sense, the food costs by making that assumption. Or you might say, in fact, we believe WFP is super efficient, okay? They're way more efficient than private sector. They can get better prices if they're buying these commodities because they can buy in bulk and so on and so forth. So we believe, in fact, the cost to them of the food basket is actually much less than, in effect, the retail value that it's being valued at. Well, again, we really have to thank WFP, who spent probably the better part of a month or so helping us work through all the details of the procurement for the commodities for three countries, for Ecuador, Uganda, and Yemen. On average, across these countries, this assumption that a food basket of $40 cost WFP about $40 to acquire, in the case of, is by and large true. In Ecuador, it cost WFP a little more than the value of the basket. In Uganda, they were basically equal. In Yemen, the food basket was a little cheaper than the retail value. But that evidence doesn't really cause us to suggest that, in fact, there were big differences across all these countries in the cost of WFP. We also want to note that we suspect that with further experience and with perhaps some standardization of procedures, it's probably quite likely that WFP could drive down the cost of either the cash transfer programs or the vouchers. For example, the cost of delivering cash transfers in Niger was approximately 6% of the value of the cash transfer. We know in other countries that's been pushed down to 1% or 0.5%. Similarly, we know a number of countries which have experimented for moving from paper vouchers, which have these very high staff costs associated with liquidation, to moving to electronic vouchers, for which those liquidation costs are much lower. So not only do we observe this difference between cash and food in terms of their modality-specific costs of delivery, our perception is, in fact, that moving forward, it's possible to push down further the cost of these cash transfers in ways which are not available for the food. We have, altogether, something like 600 pages of documentation, and although we'd really like to spend the afternoon and the next couple of days going through this with you, we're going to confine ourselves to two slides. Slide number one. As I mentioned in the introduction, people often say, well, we all know that people prefer to receive cash, or they prefer to receive food. So we asked that question to beneficiaries at the end of the survey. And it was asked in such a way that, to put it loosely, people were said, well, if this could happen all over again, would you like to get all your transfers in cash? Would you like to get all your transfers in food? Or would you like some mix? And here we just put on the two all categories. So the blue is people who said they would like to receive everything all in food. The red is people who said they would like to receive everything all in cash. And what you can see is in some countries, the red bars are higher than the blue bars. And in other countries, the blue bars are higher than the red bars. And that tells us, first of all, that this claim that people everywhere always prefer one modality rather than the other is probably not right. Second, there are some interesting differences, okay? In Ecuador, let me take Niger. Niger, where households that received the food basket, not surprisingly, said, we really like the food basket. If we could do it all over again, we would like to have everything in food. But what is really interesting in the Niger results are the cash findings, okay? One of the issues that people sometimes have with these questions about preferences is a phenomena that psychologists refer to as priming, okay?
What?
Which is referred to as priming. The notion that I was a food beneficiary, that worked out pretty well for me. Now you're saying what I would like? Well, no, I'm thinking in my mind that food was pretty good. So I'm going to say food. So in other words, to a certain extent, the modality I receive might bias my expression of preference. And if I think there's some gaming going on, if I say to you, oh, I really liked what I got, I might be more likely to get that in the future, that could also influence these choices. So what's interesting when we look at these is not so much that people in Niger who got food said they really liked it, but to a certain extent is comforting from a programmatic point of view, but looking at people who got something and they said at the end, well, I really would have liked to have gotten something else. And a good example of this is the people who received vouchers in Niger. Vouchers in Ecuador, sorry about that. Okay, that only 56% of people who received vouchers in Ecuador actually said that if we could do that all over again, we would like to have gotten everything in vouchers. And the vouchers are really interesting because along with the vouchers that you received could only be used for certain types of foods. And these were foods which fundamentally were really good for you. And what people are saying, relative to either people who got food or cash, is we really didn't like, in a relative sense, that constraint on our choice. We would have liked to have had more freedom to choose the items that we purchase. Now, this is something we probed in focus groups. And our suspicion is the following, that what people said oftentimes is they didn't like going to the supermarkets where these vouchers were to be redeemed because the supermarkets were really expensive compared to market traders or to local stores. But when we looked across the price data that we collected in these localities, we really saw no meaningful evidence of those price differences. Sometimes some items were a little more expensive in supermarkets, sometimes they were a little cheaper. But there was no clear pattern that supermarkets were always more expensive than these other types of market outlets. We think, in fact, that there may have been some stigmatizing behavior going on the part of some of the supermarkets. For example, people who were trying to purchase with their vouchers might have been told to stand aside and wait for the real customers with cash to pay for those foods. And that also would be playing into this relative dislike of the vouchers. Takeaway points on this is this claim that, in fact, people always prefer one type of modality over another doesn't look to be right. But also, where information lies on these preferences is when people say they want something different from what they were given. And this might reveal very useful information, about either particularly in relation to programmatic design or implementation. Other things. We looked a little bit on stunting and wasting anthropometric indicators. We did not expect to find big effects, given the relatively short duration of the interventions, and that proved to be the case. We looked at anemia in Ecuador and Uganda. Found no effects in Ecuador, which slightly puzzled us, but found some interesting effects on improving anemia status amongst preschool children who were recipients of cash transfers. Mentioned already that there was no evidence that beneficiaries sell their food rations. A persistent worry anytime you suggest you're going to provide cash is someone will say, well, they're just going to waste it on beer, cigarettes, other stuff like that. We had very good information on that in Uganda and Yemen. In Uganda, where beer consumption is widespread, in Yemen, where the consumption of chat, this mild narcotic, is widespread, and we found virtually no evidence that cash transfers were being used for those purposes. We found no evidence that differential modalities had adverse effects on intra-household decision-making as it pertained to women, or on social tensions between host and refugee communities in Ecuador. We found in Uganda that the cash transfers had positive impacts on certain elements of child development outcomes. Niger, households that received cash were more likely to both incur and pay off debts. And finally, one of the things we wondered about is whether or not to receive certain transfers meant that you received, that you incurred higher private costs to do so. And so that was, again, something we explored in terms of people's amount of time people had to go to places to get their payments, that they had to wait to receive those payments, private costs they might have incurred to actually take transport there or transport back. And fundamentally, these don't differ across modality. What they do reflect are basically fundamental decisions made about placement of payment points. So for example, in Niger, the ATMs would drive into the village, people would line up and get their cash. In Niger, they also constructed granaries where they stored grains in each village. And so on the payment date for people getting grains, people lined up outside the granary. And so again, there were no differences in either people's waiting costs or their private financial costs in terms of accessing these. To sum, we start off with the following, that across a range of interventions in a variety of settings, cash transfers generally, but not always, across a range of interventions in a variety of settings, cash transfers generally, but not always, proved more effective in improving WFP's core food security indicator, the food consumption score, and at significantly less cost. Further, we found little evidence that cash had adverse impacts as measured by the creation of social tensions, changes in intra-household decision-making, or purchase of intoxicants. But this does not imply that cash is always better than food. Policy and intervention design discussions need to shift from their current ideological and political focus to one that emphasizes the following. First, greater precision in intervention objectives. noted, if your desire is to improve the quality of diet, then the indicator you should care about is something like the food consumption score, which captures that. If your fundamental policy objective is to say we basically want to stuff people full of calories, then some sort of measure such as caloric acquisition might be the better measure to use. To say in general, oh, we just want to make people better off and we want to improve food security, fundamentally is not helpful in terms of trying to determine whether or not a cash, an in-kind, or a voucher is the more appropriate modality to use. Second, it's important that there's more nuanced understanding of context. One of the things that we puzzled over for a long time is how could it be that the food basket was generating relatively more diverse diets in Niger than the cash transfer. And it was only when we went back and looked more closely at the way in which those food markets worked that we realized that in Niger, that in fact, the grain markets worked fabulously well. It was a great place in that sense to do this type of intervention. But people just didn't have access to the physical commodities which would allow them to diversify their diet. And finally, we think there's a need for much greater emphasis on costing of these interventions, not just to focus on their benefits. In our discussions we've had with WFP, as I've said, you know, we're immensely grateful for the staff time they devoted to help us understand the cost in these interventions in these diverse settings. But it was also very striking to us how hard WFP itself found it to actually generate these costing numbers to allow us to do these comparisons. And yet clearly, an important component we want to bear in mind is what are the relative costs of these types of modalities. We saw in the example I worked through that the opportunity cost of choosing one modality over another, in terms of the foregone population that you could provide for with a particular intervention, actually can be quite large. Thank you very much.